Hey, Randy.
Hey, Jim.
So, what I was wondering is what you wanted to talk about today.
Well, this week we're going to look at something which I like to think of as triple slit experiment madness.
Triple slit experiment madness. So this is not a double slit experiment, not a single slit experiment. This is a triple slit experiment.
That's right. And we're looking at a paper which, you know, has the much less exciting name of Exotic Looped Trajectories of Photons in Three Slit Interference.
Now, we're talking about interference first. Do you want to just talk about that, or do you want to give them a big preview about what's going to happen?
Yeah, let's start with the fact that this is a very recent experiment that was just published in December of 2016 in Nature Communications. And let's talk a little bit about the double slit experiment, which is sort of the keystone of all of quantum mechanics. This idea that, you know, when you have a screen with two slits in it and you fire one photon at a time towards the screen, that it will still create an interference pattern on the background on the other side of that screen.
So what we're looking at is one object that has the choice of going through one or the other of two paths. So it can go through the left path or the right path. And if it were just to go on one path, if you were to cover up one of those slits, all you'd do is, say, get a little dot on the screen. If you covered up the other one and opened up the one that was closed, again, you'd get a dot just in a different spot.
Mm-hmm.
But then when you take both hands away, you get sort of multiple dots. And that's like when you have a bunch of different water waves interfering with each other and creating more complicated wave patterns.
That's right. Weirdly, we think of photons as these little objects, but they have that wave-like quality, so that much like sound or water waves, when these waves break through a double slit, they create this interference pattern in the back. It's kind of strange that photons create that even when you fire them through one at a time. But it turns out you can expand this double slit experiment to three slits. And there's a very counterintuitive effect which was predicted, but I think until now had never been verified before.
Yeah, so apparently what happens is that when you actually run an experiment like this where you have three slits, you have some sort of additional terms in your wave function. So now, this is one of the issues with the paper, but normally when you look at a quantum mechanical system, you're going to take the probability amplitudes of all of the things that could happen to get from point A to point B. So you're going to square that. You're going to take wave function and its complex conjugate. That's going to get you some terms that are combinations of the different paths. And then those extra terms are going to give you your interference. So you'll get whatever it was you were going to get for just shining a light through one slot and shining a light through the other slot, plus a couple of extra terms that describe how the different paths interact with each other.
And you'd think that this would just be an additive thing, where if you had two slits or 100 slits, that you could just add the probability of the photon going through each one of the slits together, and then add your interference term and end up with your probabilities. But that's oddly not what's happening. It seems like they're saying in the beginning of the paper that the customary way of looking at the problem, which is sort of by taking into account each slit and then each pair of slits, doesn't give you the complete Feynman path integral possibilities. That you have to, apparently they went back to Maxwell's equations and created, you know, a new analysis, which revealed that the photons can do something totally insane and go through the first slit, come back out through the middle slit, and then go through the third slit before striking the screen.
And that's exactly what you'd expect with the Feynman sort of path integral. So if you're actually reading some of his own descriptions of what you can do with these path integrals, they're allowed to just do anything that they want. If it's for a short enough period of time, light is allowed to speed up and slow down, just so long as on average, and when you have enough time to check it out again, it's doing the right thing. So it's kind of weird, but with that path integral thing, you're really adding up all of the various possibilities.
Anything that can happen, it does happen with some probability is the idea, right?
It turns out that you can figure out that the thing that's most likely to happen is usually much, much more likely to happen than anything else. Like, you know, going through one slit. That's much, much more likely to happen than going through all three slits.
And in the routine experiment, it's so unlikely for it to go through all three slits that you couldn't experimentally detect it. But they figured out a way to do that.
Yeah, and this was with the surface plasmons.
Yep, by manipulating the geometry of the slits, their placement, and making them out of a conductive gold metal, so that the surface plasmons would be amplified. They were able to increase the probability of this happening by two orders of magnitude. I'm not exactly sure what the number is, but at least 100 times. And therefore, they were able to experimentally observe it in some really striking photographs that they show in their paper.
Which photographs do you mean?
There's some illustrations there that show a number of the photographs, I guess, that are superimposed. I guess the first appearance is in figure 1G. And then you also see the same phenomenon in figures like 3A through C, where these destructive interference lines show up and break up the region of light intensity on the screen.
Yeah, they do a very good job of showing this in certain spots, and they get really, really good agreement, which is very nice, although I can just tell everything looks like it really, really agrees really, really well. I can't really tell personally how this is different from the other method of constructing the wave function, but what they are doing does predict their theory quite well. I think at the end they do show some plots that show that, you know, as you change the wavelength, you get to different spots where you have a lot of this wave mixing. So that's all very, very interesting, you know, that there's this extra term. So rather than just having to worry about these three terms, you know, one through the left slit, one through the middle slit, one through the right slit, you have to add in just a little bit extra for these three slit effects. I'm not sure, maybe it can do a loop-de-loop too. It can go in A, go back through B, and then go out A again.
I'm not so sure about that, because I was thinking about that, and I was looking at figure 1D shows the pointing vector at each slit, and I guess these are created by having the plasmon surface waves at a certain scale, and it looks like there's really only one way that it can sort of snake through all three slits, because if you look at them, the pointing vector doesn't really give you a potential which leads back around to another slit. Each one is biased a little bit in just the right way that it can create this looping pathway.
Okay, so the pointing vector is something to do with an energy flow.
It's like a momentum thing, right?
I think it is related to the momentum in the electromagnetic field. I remember it's E cross H, but I don't remember exactly how it's related to the momentum.
So it gives you the radiation pressure, right? It's almost like a flow of the field that sends you in a given direction. I was looking at figure 1D and in B specifically, the middle slit, above and below B, the pointing vector is heading to the right, so the pressure, like the radiation pressure, isn't going to allow the photon to head back to A because that's to the left.
Yeah, if you look at that, it looks like that's the only thing it can do. So there is a slight difference. The pointing vector, one, it's just at a specific spot. So it's a momentum density representing energy flow, but it is sort of a density. And then if you integrate it over the volume, you get the total electromagnetic momentum in the field.
Well, what is interesting that I don't think they addressed this at all, and this is what kind of agonizes me about these experiments, is they show a couple different illustrations of this pathway that sort of makes an S-shaped path from the point of emission into the screen. And in both of them, the loop is kind of at a different scale. Like, how far does the photon travel, like, when it goes around from one slit to the other? And when I'm looking at this pointing vector diagram, it seems to me like that photon should pretty much hug the slits, the wall that has the slits in them, because if the photon isn't traveling pretty much parallel to that slitted screen, then it's going to experience the pointing vector to steer it back around to the next slit and then change direction. So what agonizes me is that they didn't do any single photon time of flight measurements to figure out exactly how long the pathway would be. You should be able to estimate the time, right? And therefore the length of the path?
Yeah, I'm not completely sure. I mean, they might not be able to do that within the parameters that they have. So they have...
Oh, that's right, because we're talking about a screen that has little slits next to each other that are on the scale of, like, micrometers.
Yeah, and on top of that, they have a fairly well-known amount of energy, right? Which means that they probably have some additional time uncertainty.
Okay. I wonder if that's like going to be theoretically within the bounds of that uncertainty.
That would be interesting to find out. I'm looking at this figure 1C. It actually has some very interesting things going on there. So it has more than one direction that these photons are sneaking through. I think that's one of these figures that you're looking at. I have a feeling that these are all just examples of the different sorts of things that can happen. And I expect that there's a range of behaviors for each one of those different possibilities. The one that snakes through all three loops, the one that goes through one loop, sort of hugs the wall where the slits are in, and then comes back around. And the one that shoots off towards one slit, then decides it wants to go through another one instead at the very last instant. And I think there are probably multiple ways and multiple distances that each one of these can happen.
It'd be awesome if we could time that somehow, wouldn't it?
Yeah, even in the supplementary note, there's not really enough information for that to figure it out. But my feeling is that this is just a schematic. It's not actually telling you how far it can actually do that.
Yeah, basic idea, yeah.
Now, did you get a good idea from this, how the surface plasmons did this?
Well, they do go into great detail about how the polarization makes a huge impact. And so I gather that the electrical charge of the photon itself, if it's oriented in the proper plane to the screen or to the slits, will induce a sympathetic charge in the metals. That was my sense of it. It's that induction that seems to be guiding the pathway.
Okay, so were they talking about an electric charge on a photon?
Well, they're talking about polarization, so that's what you're talking about, right? Is that the oscillation is happening. When they had the oscillation happening in the direction that's parallel to the slit, they didn't really see an effect, or if they did, it was negligible. But then when the polarization of the photon was perpendicular to the direction of the slit, that's when they saw the really striking results with their photographs that give us that broken line.
So that's not an electric charge on the photon. That's saying that the oscillations in the wave function are in the one of those two directions, either in the vertical or the horizontal direction as they're going through this plane. That's actually kind of interesting that the oscillations in the wave function can do that. I wouldn't really have expected that based on what I know.
Well, I mean, it's like an antenna, right? Isn't polarization related to the electrical current?
Well, the polarization is related to the electric field. So it's...
Electric field, right.
So it's the direction that the electric field is oscillating in. And if you're thinking about it as lots of photons in a beam, then, you know, you can think about these oscillations that way without too much issue, right? You're just saying, so my oscillations are in this one direction, right? So my electric field is changing in that direction. And the surface plasmons, which are sort of like electrons, they're quasi-particles in the gold that include effects from electrons as well as effects from the lattice. And so if you have a bunch of photons running through this one thing creating an electric field, that electric field will make the electrons move, and that'll create more electric field, right? And that is going to affect the electric field that you see at some other point, right? At the end point. And therefore, you know, whatever it is that the photon is doing. It's a little weirder in the idea that this is the wave function that's polarized in that direction, which is all you have if you have a single photon. If you have a single photon, you don't have a big electric field running around. So exactly how that's working, I'm not completely sure. It has something to do with this near field, which is, I'm assuming, the reaction of the surface plasmons to the presence of the photon. I'm not sure if that means that there's something in the surface plasmons that's modifying the photon wave function, or if what you're getting is an aggregate of the possibilities of the photon actually interacting with a surface plasmon and you know, exciting it, and then the surface plasmon later on expelling another photon out, and so forth and so on. So I'm not really sure how that works in this case. it should be one of those two things. But their own modeling was actually classical, as I recall. So rather than modeling the wave function, they modeled the electric field using Maxwell's equations. And therefore, the idea is that previous one that I was talking about with many photons, and that's a little easier to grasp what you should be thinking about while you're thinking about it, which is, you know, you've got this electric field that's actually changing in the direction that the surface plasmons are, right? And so that's making the surface plasmons play around a little bit in some way.
Well, I know that there was a very specific frequency where they noted that they get the effect. There's a dynamic interplay between the width of the slits, their space between each other, and the frequency of the photon they send through. And I guess they've got to get them all those little slits very close together so that the near field is coupled all the way across. So that's a pretty complex mechanism, that three-slit near-field plasmon effect that we're seeing there.
And they had to do a lot of things to actually figure out what was going on. They looked at things sort of combinatorically, and they went through all seven possible configurations of those three slits. All three slits, each of the two pairs and each of the slits all by itself. So they went through all of those to try to figure out what was going on. They didn't just, you know, look at the three slits and say, this is close. What they said is, we're going to look at each one of these in isolation. We'll look at each pair, and we'll look at all three together. And, you know, we'll build up the whole thing and see how the differences between this pair and that pair and the all three, we'll look at all those differences. And that will tell us whether or not we see extra stuff in the wave function or not. It's not just look at the result of one experiment and say, this fits what my computer program said.
Yeah, they ran tests, I guess, to photograph each possibility of single and pairs and then all three together. And I think what they did was they took photos of all those and then subtracted out the others in order to produce an image that is really strikingly clear, that shows the interference pattern of just the three slit pathway. You know, I was kind of surprised that they, and I don't think I understand this very clearly, but the photon that they sent through had a wavelength that was like four times larger than the width of the slit. And maybe that has something to do with the coupling between all three of those slits. Maybe you need a larger wavelength photon to activate the plasmons all the way across.
I think there's a sweet spot for a lot of things at that length. So you can actually resolve things that are smaller than the wavelength, but not much smaller. I think a quarter is perfectly reasonable.
That adds support, and I like what you had to say about maybe the photon is getting absorbed by the plasmon field and then getting re-emitted.
I think that's how you're going to have to look at it when you're looking at the plasmons, is that the photon can't interact with the photon. The photon has to interact with one of these electrons that is a constituent of the plasmon. And the thing that I'm not sure about is whether you'd look at it that way or you'd look at a photon going through the slit as being yet another quasi-particle, which would be a photon in a slit with...
Coupled to the electrons.
That's actually coupled to the electrons. So that would be another possibility. And then the ground state would be equivalent to having no photons there, and then the next state would be equivalent to having one photon in there, and so forth. Yeah, as soon as you start making these quasi-particles, it starts getting weird.
Yeah, because they're not intuitive. They're these quasi-particles, these weird sympathetic reactions between all these different factors. But it is just interesting that they're looking at it. Paper is the very classical effect of, you know, look, this photon moved in this S-shaped trajectory, which seems totally insane.
That is insane, but it's probably the right way. I think, in the end, the right way to look at most quantum mechanical things is through that path integral formulation. If for no other reason, then we know that the path integral is always going to be viable relativistically. Whereas, you know, the standard quantum mechanics isn't always viable relativistically, and we did that on the other podcast over and over and over. If you're not worried about special relativity, quantum mechanics is even weirder than it has to be.
I like that. So is there a pathway where the photon just loops straight back to the source or in that general direction? They didn't seem to get into that at all, but it seems like it should be possible.
I'd expect that there is something there, but I expect that it's such a low probability that you're not going to have to worry about it.
But it seems like the pathway through one slit and then back out the other towards you should be more probable than through all three slits. So you should be able to put a detection screen at your emitter and still see an interference pattern, right?
Yeah, that might be a little bit more difficult because you're going to have all of that extra intensity that's bouncing off of your...
off the metal.
So that might be even more difficult. But I expect there's some probability somewhere for that sort of thing to happen. You know, when they're talking about how this actually works, they're talking about using, you know, computer simulations to figure out what the wave functions are. It's not going to be something that, you know, you can do on the back of an envelope and figure it out. The theory that they're working with is complicated enough that they're using these finite difference time domain simulations.
Oh, it's amazing that the photographs of their data set so clearly shows the interference effect of that extremely unlikely three-slit trajectory.
Well, it would be interesting to know exactly how many photons they're actually counting, right? It would have to be quite a few.
I'd love to see them make a subsequent experiment where they're firing the photons through one at a time. Well, this is pretty fascinating stuff. It's certainly not what you'd conventionally expect out of an experiment like this, and it's really fun to see. I'm not sure what the applications are going to be, but this is one of those wonderful... I feel like every show that we do about quantum mechanics, we should prelude with something like, you're not going to believe this, but...
That's sort of the way these things work. Yeah, I mean, it would just be interesting to figure out exactly how this works out. You know, they're adding that one contribution to the looped trajectories, right? But they have at least three different kinds of looped trajectories. So it'd be interesting to know what the criteria are to figure out which of these trajectories is the trajectory that they consider is important. Because it's not too difficult to figure out what they mean by the wave function for going through A, the wave function for going through slit B, the wave function for going through slit C. The wave function for going through the loop trajectory, I'm not sure what it is. I guess it's all of the possible loop, but they don't categorize all of the possible loop. Possibly these three are the only possible ones. I don't know. I'd still like a loop-de-loop. Coming back to the laser, that's perfectly fine too. But, you know, it's possible that you just have this S shape and these other two shapes that are almost S shape.
If it was possible to do like a circle around or in and out of the two different slits, it would be freaking amazing if there was some way to suspend a photon in that trajectory for a while.
Oh, just get it going around in a circle?
Yeah, I wonder how many times you could make it do that.
That would be interesting. Actually, in that case, what you have to do is you have to replicate this experiment here with a double slit, because if it could do that to loop, then it could do that loop-de-loop with the double slit. And if it can do the loop-de-loop with the double slit, then you can try to amplify the effect even more to get multiple loop-de-loop.
Right. I wonder how long you could sustain it. Who knows?
Yeah, probably not very long unless you did something that actually powered something. You might have to figure out some way to do this all inside of a crystal. So the double slit embedded in a crystal, and that crystal have a large electric field on it to be able to get that to work.
Well, that would be really interesting in and of itself, trapping energy in a crystal.
Well, you're not trapping energy. I mean, it's just like electromagnetically induced transparency, right? Well, maybe not just like it, but similar to it. So you'd have to do sort of the same kind of trick, although you wouldn't necessarily want to do the exact same trick. You'd want to do something to alter the environment so that it was possible to keep this up over and over and over again.
Another thought that occurs to me is, it seems like they chose gold to make this triple slit experiment to amplify the effect of the plasmon field. Do superconductors have an even higher plasmon interaction?
I don't know. I don't think so.
I don't think I've ever seen like a double or a triple slit experiment of any kind, where the material is basically a quantum object. I thought that might be an interesting thing to look at.
I guess they do have superconductor plasmons. So I'm wrong. They've got them.
Oh, okay. Is there some kind of performance factor for plasmonic materials that you could look at that would be like a coefficient of plasmonic induction or something?
I don't know. All I know is that everybody that I've known who's done stuff with plasmons has used gold.
I just assumed that was because it works well at room temperature and you don't have to do crazy stuff like cool your apparatus down to, you know, nitrogen, liquid nitrogen temperatures.
Well, you mean liquid helium temperatures? I guess maybe with high temperature superconductors, you could do it that way. But
yeah.
You know, those are even more complicated beasties.
Probably also be hard to make these incredibly tiny slits in them.
Yeah, I don't know what that would do to all those weird ceramic properties that they have. Now, lead, it would be easy to make little tiny slits in it, I'm sure. But those ceramics, I have no idea.
Well, all right, fair enough. Anything else you want to add to this discussion?
My first reading through this, I thought it was even cooler than it was, because I thought it was going to say, you know, there was something really weird with the Born rule. But instead, it looks like there's just a disconnect between the Feynman path integral stuff and the standard quantum mechanics, which is sort of obvious just by looking at the way you have to interpret it. You know, looking over all possible paths and seeing what the probabilities are as compared to using potentials and differential equations to try to figure out what happens at the end. So it's not too much of a surprise to me that in some fairly complicated situations, the naive way of moving from that QED idea to the standard quantum mechanical idea of the wave function is not going to always be a one-to-one, and you have to actually think a little bit more about how to characterize the paths when you're trying to push something back into a standard quantum mechanics rather than QED.
Yeah, this really does do a nice job of pointing out the fascinating properties of plasmon interactions with photons.
There you go. Sounds great.
Well, all right, Jim. Thanks for your time tonight.
Thanks for calling, Randy. We'll see what we can do next week, all right?
Sounds great, Jim.